Today at Reader's Corner, Franz De Waal, author of Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Humans think, feel, and plan for the future. We say hello, we say goodbye. We design and use tools to our advantage. But what if animals can do these things also? What if we've just never really understood how to discern animal intelligence? Biologist and primatologist Franz De Waal challenges us to think more like an animal in his new book, Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? Dr. De Waal is best known for his work on the behavior and social intelligence of primates. His first book, Chimpanzee Politics, Comparing the Schmoozing and Scheming of Chimpanzees Involved in Power Struggles with That of Human Politicians. Ever since, Dr. De Waal has drawn parallels between primate and human behavior, from peacemaking and morality to culture. Dr. De Waal is the C.H. Chandler Professor in the Psychology Department of Emory University and Director of the Living Link Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center. He is the author of numerous books, and his scientific work has been published in hundreds of technical journals in such as Science, Nature, and Scientific American. In 2007, he was selected by Time magazine as one of the world's 100 most influential people, and in 2011, by Discover magazine, as among the 47 all-time great minds of science. Dr. De Waal joins us today by phone from Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. Franz De Waal, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you. I'm happy to be there.
Well, it's a privilege to have you with us. In your book, you talk about, or quote, actually, David Hume, the Scottish philosopher, who in 1739 said, "No truth appears to me more evident than that beasts are endowed with thought and reason as well as men." You say in your book that that's the perfect starting point for evolutionary cognition. Could we start by helping the layman understand what you mean by evolutionary cognition and talk a little bit about how Hume came up with this? I doubt he had a lot of empirical evidence going for him since he wasn't a biologist but a philosopher.
Yeah, but he was very interested in animals, and I think he had an open mind about them, which is not something we can say about the last century. At the moment, things are rapidly changing, but there was a whole period where you were not allowed to talk about animals having minds or animals being capable of thinking. Evolutionary cognition is an approach to animals where we judge them on their own merits, so to speak, and we see what they need their intelligence for and what they use it for. So instead of taking humans as the standard and see if they have language or if they can use tools the way we do, We judge all sorts of intelligences. So, for example, a bat who has echolocation, that seems to us not very interesting, but for the bat it's very important, and it's actually a very complex capacity to send out signals and pick up the echoes and calculating your flight from it and so on. So what the bat does is very complex, but it's not what we do, but we need to judge them on what they need and what they do. And so Hume basically was saying that he thought animals were actually quite intelligent, and he literally said something like that we should assume that if they do similar things to us under similar circumstances, that these things are related. We should not have different standards for animals than we have for ourselves, so to speak.
You report the work in your book of Wolfgang Kohler, who in 1913, I believe it was in the Canary Islands, you say, kicked off the cognitive revolution. What happened there that caused the cognitive revolution to kick off?
Well, Kohler was a German who was stationed there, many people think, as a spy to look at what kind of ships came by. But in the meantime, he had 6 chimpanzees, and I don't know where he got those. But he started experimenting. He was a psychologist, experimenting with those chimpanzees. And he did things that no one had done before, because instead of training them to do something, which is what the approach of many people was at the time, and see how well they learn, he would present them with a problem that they could not easily solve. So he would, for example, hang a banana very high. The chimps could not reach that banana. He would give them a bunch of sticks and boxes spread out in front of them, and he would see what they would do. And the chimps would stare at the problem for a long time. and jump up and things like that, but they would not reach the banana. And then he said at some point, one of them would then all of a sudden start stacking the boxes or sticking the sticks into each other, because that could be done, and making longer sticks out of it. And so he said they, in their head, they must have solved the problem, because all of a sudden they came up with the solution. So without any training, without any previous experience, just as a thought experiment, basically. And so he was the first one to suggest that animals can think and can solve problems in their head. And this was at the time absolutely not appreciated. So Köhler was, for the longest time, he was taboo, and no one talked about him because no one knew, animals were not supposed to think. But Köhler was the first one to propose that. Mm-hmm.
We apparently have long underestimated animals' abilities. And how's the research approached the testing for animal intelligence, and how should we be evaluating animal intelligence?
Yeah, so for the longest time in the last century, so to speak, we had sort of two solutions for animal intelligence, which was either it was instinct, meaning they were born with a certain tendency which looked smart maybe but wasn't smart, or they had, by just reward and punishment, they had learned what kind of things worked for them. And of course, that's very often the case. This is called conditioning. Or trial and error learning is, of course, extremely important for animals. But those were the only two things that we were allowed to talk about. And as soon as someone proposed that animals might have emotions and feelings, or that they might have thoughts or solve problems in their head or had concepts of things, oh, man, that was completely taboo and you were not supposed to speak about that. And then around the 1980s, I would say, this started to loosen up a little bit. And people came with some observations and experiments that basically said, well, this is maybe not the entire story of what animals do. And then in the last 25 years, I would say, we have had a wave of studies. And now there's all sorts of studies. And these taboos that we had until recently, they are now sort of disappearing. That older generation of scientists who didn't want to talk about anything else is also disappearing. And so we have a lot of new findings. And if you look at the internet today, there's almost every week there is something new and exciting out of animal studies where people discover, they discover that birds may use tools, or that chimpanzees can plan ahead, or that rats may regret their decisions, and so they find neuroscience evidence for that. And so almost every week there's something new now, and so there's a wave of new studies coming out.
So you spent much of your career going against the grain, so to speak, in those early years and years even before you were a young graduate student. What was behind the resistance? What was behind the reluctance to see things the way they seem so obvious today?
Yeah, I don't know what that was. Is that in order to be objective, so to speak, they avoided anything that is potentially controversial. In the U.S., of course, there was also Skinner and his followers who very much insisted that conditioning and trial and error learning could explain everything, even human behavior. They initially even took that position for human behavior. Now, of course, they had to drop that at some point because humans do more than trial and error learning. But they dropped it first for humans, and then they kept going on the animals for as long as they could. I don't know what that resistance is. There is, of course, an element of human superiority to it, which is probably a religious element, is that we humans are better than animals. We are not animals. And that's, for the biologist, I'm a biologist by training, is that that's a very strange argument, because if we are not animals, what are we? We're not plants either, so are we rocks? Or we are, of course, for the biologist, we are animals. And I look at human cognition and human intelligence as a, not as a separate kind of ability, but as very similar to what animals do. It is maybe there's some special aspects to it, but in general, it's very similar.
I mentioned in the intro your work at Berger's Zoo when you said at one point in your book you read The Prince, and it really put you in the right frame of mind that hierarchy permeates everything. And I think out of that came your book, Chimpanzee Politics. I see that Speaker Newt Gingrich back in the day thought that was such a good read that he put it on some list of recommendations he was making. You have to tell us a little bit about that, not to compare the politics of today to then, but we're always interested in learning something about what makes politicians tick, and it sounds like you you came across something back then.
Yeah, we were living through a time of chimpanzee politics, I would say. And there's, for example, one aspect is, of course, that many individuals want to have power. And so there's an attraction to power, and that's very similar to what chimpanzee males, they're constantly in the business of trying to increase their power. And the reason we speak of politics in chimpanzees is because they do it by means of coalitions. So if you have a system like, let's say, in chickens, the chickens have a pecking order. But that's each individual chicken for herself, basically. It's a female, it's among the hens, there's this very clear order. And so it's usually the biggest and meanest chicken who's the dominant and so on, or the oldest maybe. But in chimpanzees, it's very different. It's decided by coalitions. That means that if you want to be the alpha male, you have to have a buddy who helps you, and you preferably more than one. And maybe the females will help you. If you're a popular male, the females may help you. And if you then come to power, you have to give them something back. So your buddy who helped you, you need to get some privileges like mating with females or eating the best food. And if you don't keep your supporters happy, you're going to lose your position because they may support somebody else. And so that's the politics of chimpanzees. There's always a sort of transactional element to what they do. And so it's not on an individual basis like in the chickens. It's based on coalitions and support and interventions and so on. And that parallel is, of course, very strong with human politics, because human politics is very much driven by that kind of processes.
You're listening to Reader's Corner, and I'm talking today with Franz De Waal, author of Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? Well, if you take that word chimpanzee out of your description there, it is precisely the kind of leadership coalitions that develop when legislatures, for example, decide who's going to run them, who's going to be the Speaker of the House, who's going to be the President of the Senate. you nailed it.
Yeah, if you look at House of Cards, for example, which is a very cynical right. view of human politics,
right.
that's a bit like chimpanzee politics, but it is, of course, more sophisticated. But the raw processes behind it and the desire for power behind it are very similar.
So what are some of the things that we have long assumed only humans were capable of doing? I mean, the one that comes to mind right away is the ability to design tools. Could you tell us something about the progress of research in that area over the years? I think there was one a particular example that was set in West Africa where chimps were actually observed through research using tools in very sophisticated ways.
Yeah, so initially after Köhler's experiments, people said, well, that's in captivity, and maybe those chimps have learned from humans, and so they dismissed that as long as they could. But then, of course, the reports came out of the field of chimpanzees using tools in the field, and not just using tools, but making tools. Now, that was a very important issue, because there was a book written in the 50s which by an anthropologist, and the title of the book was Man the Toolmaker. And he argued, and this was, everyone agreed with him, he argued that, okay, using tools, yes, there's animals who do that, but to make your own tool by modifying something, that is not something any other species can do. And then, of course, the reports came out of Africa, for example, by Jane Goodall, but also by others, that showed that chimpanzees do modify branches to apply them and do modify their tools, and so they are tool makers. Then more recently, like I think 10 years ago, there was even a crow doing that. So in the laboratory, they had a crow, Betty the Crow, who would modify a piece of wire to make it into a hook so that she could use it as a tool. And so the tool making, it's not just tool use, but the tool making is not something that is uniquely human. And now we have these observations, what you mentioned of West Africa. We have observations of chimps bringing a whole range of tools. So they may travel to a beehive and they may have three or four different tools with them, one to poke the beehive, the other one to swap the honey out, the other one to brush it up and so on. So they have different tools with them while they arrive, which means that they must be planning. They must be collecting these tools at various stages before they go to the beehive. And those are called tool sets. And this whole planning capacity is also very interesting. There's now experiments in, in the labs about how well chimpanzees can plan ahead. And that's, of course, something that we usually assume is that animals live in the present and we can think about the future, but actually animals can also think about the future. It's not a very distant future. It's usually more like we're counting it in hours or days, but not much more than that. But they do think about the future.
Well, while we're on that subject, why don't you relate the story of Franji, the chimp, who actually figured out how to take care of herself in cold and warm weather?
Yeah, so that was something that happened at the R&M Zoo where I used to work, where when the winter was beginning, she collected all the straw from her cage to go outside, which by itself is not so special necessarily, but she was not doing it in response to the weather. She was in a very warm, well-heated building where she had a warm nest, and we were opening the door to the outside to let them out where it was cold. But before she had felt how cold it was, she collected all that straw and walked outside. So she must be extrapolating from the day before it was very cold, that today might again be a cold day. And so that kind of planning is so typical for chimpanzees, where they think ahead. In this case, she thinks ahead, I'm going to be cold and I better take my straw with me. And in another story from the same period, we had a chimpanzee female who said goodbye to others. So saying hello is, of course, something that we know of all animals. You come home and you have a dog, your dog will say hello. If you have a cat, if you're lucky, the cat may also somewhat say hello. Cats are a bit more subtle about it.
That's right.
But so saying hello is completely common. But saying goodbye, we had a chimp who we had to call in the middle of the day on occasion because she was bottle feeding a baby chimp. And so we had trained her to give the bottle to a baby chimp. But in order to do that, she would have to come in the middle of the day and we would have to give her a bottle. And before she would come in, all the chimps would be living outside on an island, a very large forested island. Before she would come in, she would not come straight into the building. She would visit particular chimps, especially her best friends and the alpha male. She would walk all the way up to them and either give them a kiss or embrace them, and then she would say goodbye to them before she would come in. And now that is also thinking ahead. So saying goodbye is more complex than saying hello. That's why so few animals say goodbye, is because it means that you anticipate the separation.
You give an interesting example of animal intelligence in how elephants can discern differences between human languages. Tell us about that.
Yeah, there was a study in Africa on African elephants who sometimes have trouble with the Maasai, who, for example, young men in the Maasai sometimes need to spear an elephant to show how their manhood and things like that. Or the Maasai compete with the elephants over water or things like that. And so they don't like the Maasai for that reason. And what the scientists did in this particular case is they played human voices to them of either women or men, or either Maasai or some other people who lived in the same area, but have a different language. And so they played these four categories of sounds to them, men and women, and then the different languages, and demonstrated that the elephants could distinguish. They were only afraid of men who spoke Maasai, and all the other sounds they didn't care about.
You also talk about the fact that we now know that elephants are self-aware, and we hear a lot about consciousness. Do animals have consciousness in the same fashion humans do? Could you explain what that means?
Well, with the self-awareness, we did experiments on elephants and mirrors. Because it was claimed by some scientists that only humans and apes recognize themselves in the mirror. Now, the problem is negative evidence. So they had tested elephants with a mirror, but it was a small mirror. The problem is negative evidence is that you never know what that means. So you can test an elephant on something and you get no results. That doesn't mean that the elephant is incapable, because you may be testing in the wrong way. In this particular case, they held up a small mirror to the elephant, and the elephant didn't do anything. And we decided, Josh Plotnick and I, we decided to do a more rigorous experiment. We started out at the Bronx Zoo in New York, and set up a very big mirror. I think it was 8 by 8 feet. And the elephant could also feel behind it, which is very important for children also, and for apes also. It's very important that they can feel behind the mirror to understand what kind of thing that is. And so we did one experiment at the Bronx Zoo, and then Josh did a whole bunch of others in Thailand where he had more elephants. And we found that some elephants, not all of them, but some of them, they react to the mirror by recognizing themselves. So what you do is you do a mark on the elephant above his eyebrow. So it's a mark that he cannot see without a mirror. And then you place them in front of the mirror to see what happens. And so some elephants, when you do that, they start touching the mark, meaning that they use the mirror to guide their trunk to the mark, and they are interested in exploring that thing. So that's self-recognition, and human children have that after the age of about 2 years. And chimpanzees and bonobos and so on, they have that. But there's very few species. There's only a handful of species that passes the test.
I'm Bob Custer, a host of Reader's Corner, and my guest today is Franz de Waal, author of Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? This sounds a bit in your book like the section where you're talking about how we evaluate animal intelligence, and that for a long time it seems as though we were using human intelligence to explore animal intelligence and not developing the right context. Could you help us with that?
Yeah, I think we were very anthropocentric, as it is called, very, very focused on what we are good at. We are good at language, that's for sure. We are good at tool use, that's also clear. So those are two things that we're very proud of and we're very good at, and we are better at it than almost anybody else, I think. Certainly language, I think language is a uniquely human thing. And tool use, there's very good tool users among animals, but humans are really superior, I think. And so we focus very much on those two characteristics, and if animals have that, we are impressed. If they don't have it, we're not impressed. But there's so many other things that animals need to do. If you live in the ocean, for example, like an octopus or a dolphin, you need very different capacities. If you live in the sky, like a bird, you need orientation and navigation and so on. So there are many things that are very intelligent that animals do that we don't particularly care about. So, for example, there's a bird who can, it's called a nutcracker, he can hide in the fall, 10,000 seeds at different locations, and most of those seeds he finds back in the spring. Now, that's a remarkable feat of memory that we cannot match, but we're not particularly interested in that because we're not focused on memory so much. But many animals have capacities that are very impressive and that are a form of intelligence. And so what I argue in the book is that we need to judge them on their own merits, and there are many different kinds of intelligence out there.
Well, you mentioned the octopus. We interviewed Cy Montgomery, the author of The Soul of the Octopus, just a few months ago. Mm-hmm. And I'd like you to relate some of what you point out about the octopus and its intelligence. I mean, it's done some incredible things, demonstrating that it knows how to escape, for one thing.
Yeah, although escaping from a tank, I'm not sure that that's the smartest thing for an octopus to do, necessarily. They may be smart getting out, but they need to be able to get back in, I would think. So, the octopus in the wild, they have excellent camouflage. So they, it's not just that they can adopt the color and the pattern of a place that, like rocks or something where they sit, but they can also imitate plants and stand still in the water and move with the water as if they are a plant. And so potential predators, because there's many predators for the octopus, potential predators, they don't even recognize that it's an animal out there. They think it's a plant. And so they have these excellent camouflage capacities, and sometimes they even mimic animals. And so there's the mimic octopus, for example, who can swim, who can look like a fish and swim like a fish. And so even though his body structure is totally different from a real fish, from a distance, superficially, it looks like there's a fish coming by. And so that's the octopus. It has all these capacities. They have an enormous brain. And again, we have ignored that kind of intelligence for very long because it doesn't fit what we do. But now I think the study of animals is changing quite a bit, and we're now judging more on what they do in their environment and what they need and so on.
By the way, you mentioned in your book when you were describing the intelligence of the octopus, you said something like some people have may decide not to eat octopus anymore. And after I interviewed Cy Montgomery for The Soul of the Octopus, I haven't had octopus since then. I don't think I'd pick it up after learning what an intelligent animal it is. Speaking of intelligent animals, let's do one more. I want to talk about the young male chimpanzee at Kyoto University and the flash memory experiment that really puts us to shame as humans.
Yeah, that is Ayumu, and if people are interested, they should look it up on the internet, and they type in Ayumu with a Y, Ayumu, and maybe memory, and they will get a video, which is truly remarkable, which shows him sitting in front of a screen where nine numbers appear in front of him on the screen. They're always in a different order, in a different place. And then these numbers disappear, and they are replaced by little white boxes. And he has to touch these boxes in the order of the numbers, so from 1 to 9. But, of course, he doesn't see the numbers anymore because they have been replaced. And the replacement is so fast, you can't believe it. It's like in 200 milliseconds, meaning in a flash they're replaced. And no person can do what he's doing. So Ayumu can do this. He has been compared with Japanese students who were trained on this task. They couldn't do it. He has been compared with the British memory champion who can memorize a whole stack of cards. He couldn't do it. And so he has beaten humans on this particular memory task, and no one knows how he does that.
That's amazing. I noticed in your bio that you are a longtime board member of Chimp Haven, which is a preserve, I believe, in Louisiana for ex-laboratory chimpanzees. I wonder if you could just share some of that with us. There's quite the controversy out there about whether or not chimpanzees ought to be used for medical experiments as they have been over the years. Is that on the decline? And is that...
That is completely out now.
Yeah.
I think the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, which is the main organization that supports biomedical research, has declared that they're not going to use chimpanzees anymore. So that's completely off the table. Meaning that chimpanzees are still now sitting at research institutions, but they're not being used for the kind of studies anymore. And that's where Chimp Haven comes in, because Chimp Haven can receive those chimps. And at Chimp Haven, we have these very large islands, like some of them like 3 or 4 acres big. I mean, very large forested islands where we can release those chimpanzees. We don't breed with them. So it's really a retirement home, basically, for them, but it's very fancy. And we hope to place we cannot have all of them, I think, but most of the chimps that are in this country, we hope to receive them there.
Given your work with African animals, there was another report, how many have there been, about the extinction of these animals over time. I wonder if you could just give us your thoughts, whether it's elephants or whether it's chimps. What's the future hold here as this planet gets more and more crowded and shoves the animals you're working with out of existence?
The apes especially worries me, because I think they are disappearing, and the habitat is disappearing. For example, for the orangutan, the habitat is being burned down at the moment, and everywhere there's bushmeat hunting going on. So we're actually pessimistic about the apes, and that the apes in the wild, they may keep existing in the reserves that exist, because they are very large and they are reasonable. They're not perfectly protected, but they're reasonably protected. But overall, the populations are declining, and it's really problematic. And zoos, of course, have all the apes and breed with them and so on. But, you know, that's not really a good replacement. We need the zoos. I'm not against zoos, and I'm very much in favor that zoos do all this work and teach us about the apes and help us preserve the species. But we actually need to also have the habitat and the wild populations. And so most primatologists are very worried about the situation, because it's really not improving at the moment.
Dr. DeWall, thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner. Again, the name of the book, Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? By Franz DeWall.
Thank you.
Next week, Candace Millard, author of Hero of the Empire, The Boer War, A Daring Escape, and The Making of Winston Churchill. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Kathleen Tuck. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.